this is Dave Douglas for Greenleaf Music and our monthly podcast, A Noise from the Deep. I'm getting over a cold, so any frogginess in my voice in this episode comes with my apologies. But I'm also confident that our guest Roxy Kass sounds fantastic. Roxy's latest record is called The Future is Female. We talk about her path in music and about WEJO, the Women in Jazz organization, and her efforts towards action to support changes in the field. We just heard her track, Nevertheless She Persisted, and I realized that we didn't get specific in the episode on where that title comes from, so you can look that up online if you're interested, and there's a good story behind it. Well, good, I don't know, but there's a story. So anyway, enjoy the new episode. Please come join us at Greenleaf Music as a subscriber to support the work that we do. GreenleafMusic.com has all the info. It's also where you can email me directly. So here's Roxy Kass, and thanks for listening. Great things about living in New York is there's just so many musicians and people doing different things. And
yeah.
So lots of people that I don't know well at all and that I'm curious about. And so in the case of having you agree to do this conversation with me, Roxy, it's really an honor.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. It's an honor for me. I was thinking this morning about, you know, high school Roxy, and I was listening to The Infinite over and over, and just how that kind of changed my view of music. And so I'm honored to be here and talking about music.
You're talking about my record, The
Yes.
Infinite.
Oh, yes.
Well, thank you so much. That's very nice. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
That's in Seattle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I grew up in Seattle. Went to Washington Middle School, Garfield High School, both esteemed music, jazz programs.
Lots of players on the scene that came out of there, right?
Definitely. Amazing musicians, lots of them in New York still, and that was kind of cool, too. I mean, it opened up a door for me. It showed me that you could do that as a path and make a living. And Anne Drummond is one of my mentors, and she was here.
Flute player.
Flute player, yes. Yeah. Yeah. She was here when I moved here, so that was nice to have somebody I could check in with.
But you're, I was playing, you know, before the intro, your piece, Nevertheless, She Persisted, and we'll talk about the title and where that comes from, and of course, all of the other related issues that it brings up and that this record brings up. But it struck me that you're writing in a sort of a deceptive way. You're working with through composition. I mean, the elements of it are very rooted in jazz and the tradition, but the forms and structures you're working with on a lot of the music on this record, at least, are more extended.
Yeah.
Is that an intentional thing?
Yeah, I find that my newer compositions are moving in that direction. You know, this record actually has kind of half tunes that I started writing a long time ago and half tunes that are really brand new. Mr. President, Nevertheless She Persisted, Ode to a Generation, they're all very, very new. And some of the tunes that are more head charts are the older ones. And I kind of came back to them and those older tunes and said, how do I make this relevant to me today? And they were sort of all unfinished and kind of maturing them in a way. But the new stuff is very much moving in that direction. It hasn't been intentional or conscious, but I have noticed it. And I think in a certain way, it's just more interesting to me when I'm composing and also when I'm playing.
Well, it frames your saxophone playing in a certain way.
Yeah.
That's a little less like, you know, front and center, let's say. Yeah. Like if I were to listen to this record not knowing, I wouldn't necessarily know that the saxophone player was the band leader composer.
That's interesting. I never really considered that, but mm-hmm. I do consider I've moved more in a direction of I want the band to be utilized in a purposeful way. So rather than just writing a tune that any group of musicians could perform, it's really for the quintet, and the writing is with those, that instrumentation in mind. So, you know, writing parts that I can't perform it without the guitar and the piano. I can't perform it without the sax and guitar. Mm-hmm. These relationships and
there's a disappointing lack of trumpet on this.
Yes.
Just had to point that out.
Yes, I now, have moved in that direction. So
Miki Yamanaka is the piano player, and I'm wondering, you know, in this area of the conversation about through composition and about you writing for these specific players, it sounds like maybe there's also some elements of more classical related music in her playing. Am I off base there? Or?
You know, yes, she grew up, I think, playing classical piano, and actually went to college, had a whole different career in Japan, and then like in her 20s decided, I want to be a jazz piano player, and move to New York. And
as you do, yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, she moved here 7 years ago, went to Queens College for her master's. And mm-hmm. when I first met her, I think I met her really soon after her moving here. She really had just begun jazz. So absolutely, there's a lot of different influences there. It's interesting.
And the blend with Alex Wintz on guitar is pretty cool.
Yeah.
I mean, it's sometimes indistinguishable.
Yeah. Part of it is just, I like that writing where it comes in and out, and sometimes you can't hear the difference. I also have played with a lot of different combinations of people, I feel like this band has a very good chemistry in that people are always listening to each other when we're playing. And
that helps, doesn't it?
Yeah. Wow.
Understatement of the year. I'll just mention it's Rick Rosato on bass and Jimmy McBride on drums and, you know, seasoned jazz players for sure. And you hear, you know, them sort of bringing all of these forces that you're working with together.
Yeah.
I guess the question that I'd want to ask in relation to this area for moving on and hearing another piece is just like, was there any artist or composer or musician that you listened to that particularly guided you to this kind of thinking and writing? You know, growing up in Seattle, of course, there's a great scene in Seattle, and it's always been a place I've gone to play, mm-hmm. and people come through, national acts, mm-hmm. but also there's a lot of great local talent.
Yeah.
And very diverse and very, let's say, artistically diverse, for mm-hmm. lack of a better word.
Definitely. I mean, I don't know that it's directly connected with my composition, but I am grateful for the music scene in Seattle. I think that it has not just a strong music scene, but like you're saying, there's lots of different little scenes. And even within jazz, people are really going for their own thing in a way I don't see in other cities.
Huh.
And I think that's really cool. I mean, in New York, you have that, because there's so many musicians. But in a lot of smaller cities, I think that there's kind of not enough musicians to have all those little pockets of people creating new things. So I was definitely inspired by that. And maybe we can get into this in a little bit, but also mm-hmm. just I grew up with artistic parents. And so
oh.
for...
Why wait?
for, yeah, I
guess. Tell me.
For what, you know, the culture in my family, I never really questioned this ideal of finding my own voice. Mm-hmm. Even, you know, I started on piano when I was pretty young, and part of the piano lessons, we did composition, like from age 5, I was composing and entering into finale and,
that's, you know, fantastic,
doing ear training, music theory.
And drinking espresso.
Yeah.
In Seattle.
So. Yeah. And so to me, like, composition, but also this idea of finding your own voice has always been built into playing the saxophone. Like playing the saxophone as a technician has never been the primary goal. It's more a way to express yourself, and composition is another way to express myself.
So you feel like also your parents, it sounds like, were involved in the arts?
Yeah, my mother, Mary Koss, is a visual artist, and my father as well was trained in sculpture. He's now in management for construction, but built our house. Yeah, exactly. Built our house. And it just, this idea that, you know, you do what you want to do, you do what you love, and you'll figure it out from there.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess, and framing the question, I think I was thinking, you know, more like Charles Mingus, Duke Ellington, you know, Mary Lou Williams, you know, artists that, you know, I remember growing up, not like one particular artist, but, you know, a range of people that I listened to that formed how I thought about what I was doing. And it seems like, you know, your path to composition, you know, from the ripe old age of 5, composition, arranging, and working with improvisers, you know,
yeah,
it's definitely based in tradition, and you've done a lot of gigs with, people that would be associated with mainstream jazz, straight ahead jazz.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so this path is sort of going beyond that, and I thought that you would name check, like, you know, famous people. None of that. None of that resonates for you.
I mean, it does. I mean, we can't escape. The music we listen to, I think, gets in our music, whether we want it to or not. Mm-hmm. And for instance, Nevertheless, She Persisted, I think I definitely wanted that Art Blakey vibe alternating with something else. And the something else was a little more obscure. I didn't know exactly what it was, but I found myself, there's this section, and on the record, we don't do any soloing over it. It just repeats and keeps adding textures, but in live concerts, we actually opened it up for guitar solo. But that section, when I was writing it on the piano, it reminded me of Stevie Wonder. And I thought, oh, this is like pop chords. Like, how do I make this R&B sound fit into this? Because it, to me, was a definite necessary part of the composition. But it was juxtaposed, like, the feels I was hearing. And so that's when the band comes in, I think. And
oh, interesting.
Kind of unifies it in a way.
Let's hear a little bit of this piece. She needed a hero, so that's what she became. Yeah?
Yeah.
Thank you. tell us anything about that music?
Yeah, this one, actually, I did have a composer in mind, Duke Ellington.
I've heard of him.
And I just thought about sort of a vehicle for the piano to improvise over. Mm. And then it shifted to like, okay, we each get a turn to feature each, the pianist, me, and the guitarist, Alex. But the idea was, this is not about a melody. It's about each person just having space. I think musically, like literally I wanted, my first instruction was like, okay, piano, when I'm playing that sort of quote unquote melody, those whole notes, I want you to play like Duke, like flourishes.
Improvise and arpeggios.
And same thing with the drums. Like I was hearing this mallety type of rumbly, just texture type stuff. But I think it's also related to Duke with like, I really just wanted to feature the musicians in that piece.
Hmm. That's really interesting. Is it, I mean, to talk about the activism of the record, do you tie those kind of compositional, improvisational strategies to the message?
Definitely. Each piece kind of like, to me, musically embodies this concept that the title is trying to describe.
The future is female.
Yeah. In this case, she needed a hero, so that's what she became. Each person takes on that superhero vibe. It's like they're leading the band and they're the person. And, you know, kind of thinking about, I didn't have a female person, a hero to look up to as a kid. I didn't know of many female jazz musicians who were like Duke Ellington on that level. I had never heard of Mary Lou Williams. Mm-hmm. And especially instrumentalists. And so just like, and continuing with what we've been talking about, I mean, really, you know, not specifically trying to mimic anyone, but saying, okay, there's room for me to create my own thing because it doesn't exist yet. And what is said if we just don't put parameters on it? Like a typical song has to have a melody. Well, what happens if we don't do that? You know, same thing, the parallel of me as a musician. What happens if I don't try to follow literally in someone's footsteps? Because I can't.
But you feel like that gave you a certain freedom. The fact that there wasn't a readily available model for you to look to. Do you feel like that's changed as you've become aware of some of the women who have pioneered some of the music?
I think at this point, I am not at a point where I would intentionally follow someone's footsteps. I'm definitely inspired by people as I come across them. We were just talking about Jerry Allen. You know, to discover that at this point is, I think, more meaningful. I think if I had grown up with it, it would have done a lot of positive for me just in the innate understanding that I can do it. Mm-hmm. But on the silver lining maybe is that now when I discover these women, it's like, wow, that means so much more to me that they created this music in what I understand now to be the reality of being a woman in jazz. And interestingly, I find that the more research I do on these women, the more parallels I see to my experience. And, you know, I was doing a lot of research on Mary Lou Williams last year and found out that she had quit twice in her career. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, wow, you know, that narrative we don't talk about, but is so common with women. Every time I talk to young women my age, we've all gone through this, like, okay, I think I'm going to quit, because at a certain point, it's like your everyday experience is very challenging and not very fun a lot of times. And so you don't want to become like a martyr for the music. You know, you want to still be doing it because you want to do it. And because if you're going to choose something hard, like you might as well, if you don't love the everyday, you could be making a lot more money doing something else and not loving the everyday.
Yeah. So do you feel like writing this record and writing such specifically activist message music, let's say, is your way into finding that for yourself?
I think partly yes. It wasn't an intentional solution to write this music. It was more a reaction, and I think all my music has been a reflection of what I'm going on, mm-hmm. what's going on, you know, in my personal life.
I'm nodding vigorously.
Yes.
People can't see that, but yeah, I can really, yeah.
I think, you know, most of my favorite composers, that's probably true with, you know, you can't really separate the music from the music is life, as mm-hmm. Wayne Shorter said. Mm-hmm. And it really, to me, it's only honest if it's reflecting those things. So for me, I was going through a huge reflection on what it means to be a woman in jazz, yeah. what it means to be a woman in America with Donald Trump becoming president.
We generally bleep out his name on this podcast,
yes.
but in your case, we'll leave it in.
Yeah, yeah. And I generally don't say his name, but I think that hopefully, you know, this will still be relevant in years to come when he's not the president. And
it was before he was president,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. And you have this piece called Mr. President.
Yes.
Which I assume refers in some way to him. And they've all been men up till now. Mm-hmm. So it is time for a change.
Yeah.
But let's listen to a little more music, and then we'll talk about Women in Jazz Organization and the other activism that you're involved in. And, you know, I'm always really curious how it takes shape in the music, and also how the music leads one to activism and all the important things that need to happen. So, but this this is your tune that's called Mr. President.
Thank you.
peace, Mr. President.
Thank you.
Roxy Kos.
Yeah. You know, it's... I definitely had him in mind. And, you know, we talked a little bit about having a musical composer or idea in mind when composing. And in this case, it was more of a just an emotional idea that I wanted to portray him as a person. And that's what the beginning of the tune is. It's, you know, the march, the Imperial Death March. and then it moves into, you know, it goes back and forth between sort of this... Latin-y party time and this really up-tempo swing. It steadily increases until the solos, which is just stays in upswing. And I saw that, you know, vacillating thing as the reality versus this news cycle that is telling everyone like that this is normal and like everything's fine, yay. And it's just so over the top. And it's like, at what point does it just spin out of control completely and we are left with the truth, which is...
One can hope.
Yeah. But that, you know, that truth essentially, even though it's much darker, is maybe, yes, we need to get back to it.
It's essential.
Yes.
It's essential and it's always there.
Yeah.
But I also think that, yeah, it's a really hard problem to talk about.
Yeah.
And everybody's pitching in and doing what they need to do.
Yeah.
A, self-care, staying sane, and B, taking on larger goals within the society to try to make change. And so you've chosen a really specific area to do that, and it's the area of your work.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, I had a lot of ideas before it started about things that I wanted to do. I live in Harlem and I was thinking I want to give back to this community and I love kids, you know, thinking about, well, maybe I should do some sort of like educational music program or I don't know, something like that. Mm-hmm. I also was aware that I had a lack of women in my everyday life, just going to gigs every day and seeing men every day and feeling that lack in my own personal life. And when the 2016 election, presidential election happened, I found myself just very depressed and then feeling like, I have to do something, but I don't want to change my career and become a politician. How can I make change? How can I give back? How can I combine these ideas? Because I don't have endless time or energy. I'm going to make it into one thing. And I think that for me, it's like trying to offer something that I needed. So it's partly selfish. It's like, I need a community of women. I need us to educate myself and have this sort of like self-empowerment thing. If I'm not going to quit, I need to, you know, delve into this side of things, reading tons of books about, you know, the history of women in America, women in the workplace, different types of things that I felt could help me in my toolkit of just being a strong person in the jazz community and in my career. And then activism and like, what can we do to change the jazz scene, the jazz community? Because to me, it's, you know, being reflected on this national stage and it's not okay. It's not acceptable. And I can't change that unless I devote my life to it. But maybe I can make a little impact on this stage, this community.
Do people ask you why your music doesn't have lyrics?
No. People sometimes ask if it does. And I think a lot of people don't necessarily understand how the titles are related to the content if they don't ask. They might think it's a gimmick. But I think that people who do understand. I was playing at Smalls with my band and afterwards, and you know, I announce the tune titles and I talk about what they're about, what they're, you know, where they came from, where the idea came from, and how it, sometimes I go into how it's reflected musically, but usually I just let the audience hear whatever they want. And afterwards, this young woman came up to me and she was around my age and she just stopped and looked at me and said, you know, I was sobbing the whole set. I had no idea there was such a thing as feminist jazz, but I love it. I didn't even know I liked jazz, but I love it. And that was like, whoa, you know.
Good. The music touched this person.
I guess that's the fun of it for me is like, how do I turn this emotion into a sound? It's sort of a puzzle, I guess. And I don't have much experience writing lyrics, so I don't feel like it's as fulfilling or satisfying for me because I haven't done it as much, but who knows what the future may hold.
And I think more people are doing it now, but do you feel like this record, the activism is more explicitly part of it than it was on your previous albums?
Definitely. Yeah. Okay. It's a very clear message, and, you know, the other albums, unless you really read what I wrote about it, you might not know what it's about just because they're obtuse enough titles. This one is a little more, you know, Feminist AF or The Future is Female. It's kind of like you can't ignore it in the same way. But again, I think it's just what I happen to personally be going through. And I am, I think, in nature just, I mean, feminist is not the right word because I hope that, you know, if others understand that word to mean what I understand it to mean, like we hopefully all are feminist or become feminists. But I think I sort of didn't even have a choice, nor am I upset about it, that I've become embodied somebody who's a very strong protesting feminist because of my life position and situation, being a female saxophone player in jazz. And I didn't necessarily, I obviously didn't choose to be a saxophone player to be that or because of that. It just sort of was like, oh, here's what I found myself in. You know, those moments like that woman coming up to me or little girls seeing me play and knowing that's an option for them.
Yeah.
That's where it starts to create bigger change because especially for children, if children see themselves in you and they have more options, that just means even if they don't choose to be a saxophonist, it just means those young girls, their world is bigger than mine was. The options and what they see that they can do. And if young people's options are bigger, that means we're going to move forward and we're going to progress as a society. And same with boys seeing, young boys seeing me play. It's like they're not going to question when their classmates who are girls want to do something that they, it's not traditionally for girls. So I think that it's a slow, the bigger change is slower. But you know, adults seeing me play, it does the same thing for them. It's just, I think, a little bit more obvious, and it's sort of met with lots of reactions.
Do you feel like a kinship with any other organizations that are working on this?
I think there are a lot of organizations and collectives and, you know, people doing a lot of important work. Key Change, you know, created, they basically have an initiative that Winter Jazz Fest implemented for the first time this year. I met Vanessa, who's, you know, kind of running a lot of things for them.
Vanessa?
Reed. Okay. And she, basically, Key Change Initiative is about creating gender equality in festivals. And they started in Europe. They're based in the UK. But I think, you know, just seeing that this is not so much a new thing, even in the last year, is so inspiring. Like when I started Wejo and I did research and there was like a very small women in jazz group in Texas and there's the International Women in Jazz, in New York. But there was nothing else really, you know, there's, Seattle Women in Jazz. They were not doing the festival that they had started. And now I go on Facebook and it's like a barrage of women in jazz groups. And a lot of them are very small, but you know, they're happening at University of North Texas, Berkeley. I mean, they're happening all over in colleges. They're happening in communities. And I think that that's really exciting because then it normalizes it. It means that all these different women are having more of a community, and it's just bringing more attention to it. And that's what we want.
And festivals, too.
Yeah.
And even Berkeley now has a huge initiative.
Yes.
Spearheaded by Terry Lynn Carrington.
Yeah. The Gender and Jazz Institute for Gender and Jazz Justice, and I just went up there and visited and worked with the students. It was really, really exciting. So I can't wait to see what happens with that.
A lot of change afoot.
Yes.
And an election coming. So let's hear this other piece that you highlighted to me. Do you say hashtag me too?
Yes.
I don't want to be
exactly
glib. So
nope, here's that's
this
it.
Composition. So that is hashtag Me Too, beautiful piece. And as you pointed out, that's you playing the bass clarinet. Mm-hmm. Lucas Pino also appears on the album on bass clarinet. But gorgeous sound, gorgeous tune.
Thank you.
Not a gorgeous topic.
No. So I actually, when I composed this, I was actually thinking about Election Day. And it started out, I was trying to portray that day, which started out very, you know, everybody was kind of excited. And everybody thought that Hillary was going to win. It was a given. And I went to a party. There were lots of little parties happening, like, let's watch the results come in and, you know, drinking and playing games. And as the news in the background, you know, as the night progressed, it was like, wait a second, confusion and what's going on? Like, this can't be real. And then, you know, that's in the piece, the guitar comes in and it's very, you know, switches time signatures, harmonically is a little ambiguous. And then, you know, essentially like, wait, okay, this is the results of the election. Like, and kind of like, let's hope in the morning it's better. And it wasn't. And that was sort of like destruction. And so that's what the piece I was thinking of. And as I was writing it, I felt myself realizing the parallels of some emotional traumas I was processing at the time, which is, you know, I thought I'm the one playing the melody at the beginning, and it sort of reminds me of this innocent version of myself as a child. And like, you go along your way and you're naive, and then you know, me too, something happens and it's confusing, and maybe a little try to suppress whatever is going on to keep functioning. And then eventually it's like, no, you have to deal with this. And I thought the parallels were kind of weird. And again, you know, the music is just a reflection of what I'm processing in my personal life. So that tune in particular was a big one for that. And so I ended up deciding that hashtag Me Too was a better portrayal of what the tune was really about than, you know, just one day.
Yeah. Yeah. You said something on the panel. I met you at a panel for Georgetown University, Jazz and Diplomacy, and this topic came up, and you said something like, you know, for a woman musician, every day is like living in a battleground.
Yeah.
Is that?
Yes.
Yeah.
And we talked about this a little bit already, but just going to the gig is making a statement. No matter what I do is making a statement in this culture that we've found ourselves in. And it's really draining, and it can feel like a fight. And I struggle now with not letting that change my personality, not being that sort of person who just has a bunch of walls up to survive. And how can I still be vulnerable so I can make beautiful music and take risks and connect with people musically, personally, and keep growing and not be afraid, you know, and not be reacting out of fear and defensiveness. But I think, you know, I don't know if I mentioned this on the panel, but the more young women I talk to, the more old women I talk to, pretty much all of us have experienced some sort of something. And maybe not for everyone a sexual assault, but some sort of discrimination, some sort of harassment. And not just once, but on a regular basis. And a lot of women, younger women especially, who may, you know, I talk to them and they say, well, it's better for me. And then as we start talking and they describe what they think is normal, it's like, okay, do you realize that that's not normal? But but when you're young, you just take your reality for granted as normal. And I think it's only later when you look back that you can say, like, that was not okay. And my peers were not having to deal with that. And but we normalize it to survive and to keep going, you know.
It's really hard to talk about, too, for a lot of people.
Yeah.
At least from what I've seen.
Yeah.
You know.
Absolutely. And, you know, there was, when Me Too happened, there was such a big pressure on women, especially women in jazz, to come out and name names and, you know, that's the only way we're going to move on. And it's like, okay, but it's also putting even more pressure on the victim, you know, more responsibility on the oppressed. And that's always not what's going to help that person emotionally. That's not, you know, let alone in their career. When we've seen what's happened, when people have come out, and it's not a positive thing. So it is hard to talk about. And it's hard to acknowledge to yourself sometimes, which makes it hard to talk about. Because when you say it out loud, it's real.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think a lot of men, you know, a lot of men, it's just hard to hear it and realize how pervasive it is and how almost everyone you know is dealing with this.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, I'd imagine, I mean, it sounds like from your earliest experiences in the music, you know, maybe you didn't have that sort of challenge to it, or would you say it goes back even to those piano lessons and composing? And
not that far, fortunately. My piano teacher was a very nice woman, so luckily music in general wasn't tainted. But I think from the beginning of playing the saxophone, there were always little moments with different peers or teachers, and nothing too traumatic in middle school or anything, but, you know, I thought a lot about how the relationship with the saxophone was very tainted for me, and it was hard to practice because it meant kind of thinking about a lot of things attached to that.
Wow.
So I had to fight against that, and I didn't realize that that's part of what it was until meeting my husband, because he's a saxophone player as well. And we talked about the process, and we talked about, you know, he just loves to practice. He can't wait to practice every day. And there's no negative things attached to that for him. It was his escape from his life, you know, things in his life. Mm-hmm. Whereas for me, I had a great life. I had great family and friends, but anything traumatic was related to jazz and music. So I kind of had to separate and realize after college, really, that just because that was the experience doesn't mean that that's the music. And I still did love the music and wanted the music to be a part of my life.
Yeah. And I would imagine that organizing the Women in Jazz organization is a big part of dealing with that personal experience and turning that into something positive and making change.
Definitely. Because it's like, at a certain point, what can I do? I have to do something about this, you know.
So what's the next step for Wejo and for Roxy?
Right now I'm getting my next record together, mm-hmm. which is going to be a live studio recording. So it's an album, but we recorded it with video. Mm. So the nature of video, you can't do as many big edits or anything. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty much live recording audio, and there'll be a digital video element as well. All music, there's eight songs. Seven of them are from all four of those previous releases, and then one arrangement of a standard that I have not released. And just kind of about the band, you know, each of these albums.
Same band, same quintet.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, each of those albums was really more about me and my personal growth. And this year has been a shift to focusing on the band, getting the band ready for the next step of, you know, touring. And we got this grant from the union and really been able to play the music together more as a band. And so I wanted to document that, even though these tunes have been recorded before. Mm-hmm. Here's what it sounds like now that we've been playing together for a lot longer. So I'm excited about that. That's coming out on Outside In Music. Mm-hmm. And Wejo is also restructuring. So I'm going through a lot of changes. We are, you know, rebranding, getting a new logo, and actually changing the organizational structure. So trying to get more people involved with, you know, taking ownership and leadership within the organization, so that we can work on more of our goals simultaneously, and more people are involved, but having less of a workload. Because, you know, when I started it was really just me. And now we've got a really solid leadership team with Tahira Clayton and Aubrey Johnson. Mm-hmm. But really now the three of us the burden is on us a lot of the time. So, you know, we've had a really successful project with Wejo Mentors. Emily Pecoraro has been basically running that. So taking that as a model, and we've had this long laundry list of ideas we want to work on for years. So hoping that this will help actually implement those and really get some things happening on the ground.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
I look forward to hearing about that. It's such a great initiative, and the mentorship thing, from what I read.
Thank you.
Just really, really inspiring.
Yeah.
And thanks for talking about all of this with me.
Yeah,
really
thank you.
Really appreciate it. So I was going to go out with this piece called Ode to a Generation.
Yeah.
A nice more way to like end it. Is it a message?
Totally.
Yeah.
I wanted to end the record on a positive note. Mm-hmm. And one of my newer compositions, I felt like, you know, everybody's talking about my generation being so terrible and whatever, but I think that it's going to be on us to change things for the better. And you can already see that, and sort of like an empowerment statement for people my age and younger.
Great. Ode to a Generation. Roxy Kos, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, listeners, if you're still here, thanks for listening. You might want to hear an extra part of this conversation where Roxy and I talk some more about Mary Lou Williams. You can check that out and a lot more on the Extras page as a subscriber to Greenleaf Music. Please join us at greenleafmusic.com, and I'll talk to you soon.